just looking at this list Pete was sharing with me, and it must be 20 small font type pages, event after event after event by every state in the union, but not just them. They're all sending their delegates and their bigwig politicians, but it's also the every advocacy group for every imaginable organization. The Cigar Makers of America are going to be in town because I think they just want to get out, and so they're going to come here and smoke cigars. Maybe in a back room somewhere. More about that a little later on. Tom Gimbel's here now, the job expert and founder of the LaSalle Network. Tom, are you going to hobnob next week with all of these folks coming to Chicago?
I tell you, there aren't. I don't think there's many back rooms you're allowed to smoke cigars in anymore, John. You got to do it out in public.
Yeah, or in a designated cigar smoking ventilated place. But yeah, those right. never look like fun to me. It's sort of like a nice place to smoke a cigar, but that's all you get to do in there, you know?
Correct. Correct. No, I'm going to go to the convention. I'm going to actually be there on. I'm fortunate enough to be there on Thursday night to see the acceptance.
And as a representative of you, how is it that you're there?
Yeah, just I was fortunate enough to get a pass, and it's historic. Whether the final result in November is win, lose, or maybe draw,
yeah.
It's a historic thing in that it's in my own city, and that a group was nice enough to extend me a ticket. And I think no matter what anybody's political affiliation is, you got to participate in the process and. To witness history is a really impactful thing, whether you agree or disagree.
My brother was at the convention when Trump got elected or nominated, and I don't think my brother voted for Trump, but I know that he just thought that was really just such a thing to see, to witness, just all of the advocacy, all of the groups, all of the enthusiasm, even if he didn't share it entirely. He did not regret going. I'll say that.
No, you're part of the process, and you get to see it and witness it, and I just think that so much has been lost in this country of the office over the individual, and we should hold the office in respect whether we agree or disagree on the person who holds it.
I called you today just to talk about if the labor market is slowing, and it's slowing.
Slowing.
But you wouldn't describe it as slow, would you?
I'd describe it as slowing.
Yeah, which is different, but okay. In other words, jobs, but fewer and maybe harder to get. So then I wonder what you do when you get a job offer, if you should just take it or if you should negotiate for the things you were negotiating for a couple of years ago.
Yeah, well, two things. Number one, back to your comment about slowing. If you're going 60 miles an hour, you might think that that's not that fast. If you're going 100 miles an hour, right? That's fast. If you slow down from 100 to 60, then 60 seems slow, but it's still fast, right? So there's a delta in what you compare things to. So I think the job market's definitely slowed down, especially for kids out of college right now, which we haven't seen in a long time. And I think if you get an offer, you've got to be very careful on the negotiation strengths or weaknesses that you have. And it really depends at what level of your career. It depends on the uniqueness of the job that you got, and it also depends whether you're employed currently or unemployed. And there's an expression, don't look a gift horse in the mouth, and that's probably applicable right now for a lot of job seekers when they get an offer.
I saw a story at CNBC, and it said, before heading into any conversation with an employer, make your list of compensation must-haves, nice-to-haves, and non-negotiables. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. I think that, to me, I've always associated or analogized getting a job offer to the same thing as buying a home. You think you want a two-car garage. You think you want an attached garage. You think you want a finished basement until you walk in and you see the kitchen of your dreams or a backyard that's so great for your kids to play in. And then all of a sudden, some of the other things aren't as important. So I really believe that you want to go in and focus on the overall package and have things ranked, but very rarely is there a non-negotiable especially when you're unemployed. Again, if you're moving from one job to another, that's a very different situation, John.
Well, what's your advice on this? And not from the employer's perspective, but the employees. If I'm got an interview, and it looks like we're about to negotiate some of the terms, including price. Should I let them make the offer first, or should I make the offer first? Should I say it's got to be $100,000, and I'll be willing to go $90,000, or should I wait for them to make an offer, because maybe they're going to offer $110,000? And if I'm
looking, you should wait for the employer. You should
really.
You should wait for the employer to make the offer. Now, there's a lot of things that you can line up in your favor. If you're using a recruiter, then you should be very candid with the recruiter on what you're looking for. But if you're working directly with the company, you know, I'm a big believer. There's laws that have been put in place over the past few years that a company can't ask you how much you're making. They can't ask for your salary history. And that's fine. But if you get lowballed on it and they end up not wanting to come up to where you're at, you only have yourself to blame. And I get if you feel you're underpaid, then you don't want to go out and put that out in the universe. At the same time, if you want a fair offer based on what you've made in the past, to be forthcoming on where your compensation is probably isn't the worst strategy, especially in a tighter job market.
Okay, wait a minute. To be forthcoming with my compensation means I'm going to tell them, here's what I want, not wait for them to make an offer.
It's at different phases of the interview. So when they're we'd like to put an offer together, and then at that point you say, well, what I'm looking for is $100,000. You're being a little bit
presumptuous.
Presumptuous. I just think I'm a little old-fashioned in this regard. Now, what should have happened is you should have gotten what the job the salary range was initially when you applied for the job, or when the dialogue started, that they're going to say, what are you looking for, or this is where the range is. Now, where you get into a gray area is they say 100 to 120. That usually means the employee or potential employee is thinking 120 and the company's thinking 100.
Yeah.
Right? And that's where the negotiation is.
Tom Gimbel's a job expert and founder of the LaSalle Network. I'm interested to hear your report next week after you visit the DNC, maybe the following Monday, but it's always good, or Tuesday. It's always good to talk to you, Tom.
Absolutely, John. Stay safe and enjoy this great summer weather.
Philip Weiss joins us now, the president of SciFarth at Work. What's your business, Philip? What is it that you guys do over there?
Well, we do a lot of the training, companies of all sizes, John, on business requirements, legal requirements, how to be effective in customer service. So anything that affects the workplace, we help companies do it right. A lot of it is reducing the law when there's a legal issue to simple, clear sound bites. So all that complexity, we try to take it away so people can do their best on a daily basis.
And what's the range of clientele that you have? How big? Are they regional, local? Who visits with you?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I appreciate it. It ranges anywhere from a mom and pop type company. We've had companies with two employees that have come to us all the way to the Fortune 10, and we train globally. So right now we're training in Asia, Middle East, Europe, and across the U.S. So a lot of what you and I talk about connects to the kind of issues that managers worry about, and we convert that into really simple tools and messages they can use when they manage their people.
Well, I imagine, though, managing people in Asia is different than managing them here. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. And so while many of these companies that span the globe will have a universal code of conduct, because they want to have some standards, certainly, that apply everywhere. You know, people rotate around. Business clients deal with different entities on the same day or week. So some consistency is crucial, but you have to build in the local norms. You have to build in the local traditions. And even when we train, we will introduce a topic differently if we're in Germany versus if we are in the UAE. So you're absolutely right. It relates to what we do and what we share in terms of information.
What do you say about commuting? Are companies working to make getting to and from the job easier these days? Is that an area about which employees ask employers to do something?
Yeah, it's a really big the reason why is with successive waves of employees being told this year you're coming back to the office or you're coming back more often, companies have realized the employees are somewhat reluctant and we're so used to the comfort of home or the flex benefits that they want that commute to be made much easier or supported in some way. So we've been talking to our clients, and that support ranges anywhere from subsidized transit passes to setting up electronic message boards in an office so people can share information and come up with ways to carpool together, even bike purchase or bike repair stipends so people can come in on two wheels, not four. So there's a whole range of ways you can make, you know, create a kinder, gentler commute for people that are a little leery about coming into the office more often.
I'll bet those bicycle considerations are a much bigger deal in a lot of other countries than in the USA.
Yeah. Interestingly, you know, you were talking about our global client. The U.S. companies, John, will talk to the European and Asian operation leads to say, okay, what has helped you when it comes to assisting people who want to bike into work? Because sometimes there's these horrible misses on the planning side. We have a client, actually a Southern Illinois company that sells tools, and they, without thinking about it, just said, let's buy bikes for our staff, encourage them to bike in warm weather. And they didn't really think about the routes people would take. That company happens to be located in a somewhat congested area. And the bosses were then inundated with emails, John, from employees who reported near misses, semis, ambulances, and the like. So even though it's a fairly rural area, and that was kind of the guiding principle, the company did not think through what this would mean to their employees. So you got to be thoughtful, and you got to be planning carefully.
I know you've got more to say about that. I spent too much of our time just talking about the way you all do business, but I think that's fascinating. We'll resume this part of the conversation another day. It's good to talk to you, Philip.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, John.
Philip Weiss is the president of Cyfarth at Work. Jared Dilliam, the best-selling financial author of the new book, No Worries, How to Live a Stress-Free Financial Life. Jared, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me.
I haven't had you on in a while, but I'll ask you the same question I've asked some people lately, and that is to put last Monday into some context for us. Was that a seismic shift in the economy and our ability to retire, or was that just some sort of speed bump? What happened last week, Jared?
Yeah, I think we're still trying to figure that out. You know, it was a combination of a lot of things. It was an unwinding of the yen carry trade, which you probably heard about, which is where people borrow in low-yielding currencies and invest in high-yielding currencies. It was a little bit of an unwind of short volatility trades. There was a lot of concentration in the market. Tech stocks had run up a lot. They were making up a big percentage of the market in terms of market cap. You had geopolitical tensions in Iran and Israel, and potentially some political tensions here now that Kamala Harris has, you know, become the front runner for the presidential election. So I think it was just a combination of things, and it resulted in a big liquidation event last Monday. As to the question of, you know, what does this mean long term? Probably not too much. You know, as you can see from the price action today, the stock market is marching higher. I will say that there's a chance that the Fed is a little bit more hawkish than people think they will be. 2-year interest rates are at 4%, and Fed funds interest rates are at 5.5%, which means that the market is expecting a lot of cutting. And if it doesn't happen, then it could lead to another sell-off.
So at least 0.25 in September then?
I suspect we're going to get a 0.25 at a minimum. I think the market wants a 0.5. In fact, I'm pretty sure that I think the market will be disappointed with a 0.25. And I think the market will be disappointed if we don't get some language that we're going to get more rate cuts in the future.
Well, I think the future, if you define it as the next 12 months, most folks expect several cuts. Are you in that camp?
I am in that camp, and I actually believe that it's warranted. I believe the economic data is weak enough, and it's been weak for a while. I think that, you know, at least 100 to 150 basis points of rate cuts are warranted. But, you know, you're dealing with Jay Powell, who is very hawkish, and he's very concerned about inflation, and he's concerned about a second surge of inflation. So he's going to be very reluctant to cut rates any more than he has to.
Do you think the market's going to continue to propel then over the, say, through December? Are you bullish for the next 5 months?
I'm kind of neutral. Like, usually when you have some sort of sell-off or dislocation like we just had, it becomes self-fulfilling, and you get a second round of it in the third round, and it leads to a larger correction. So far, that hasn't been happening, which I'm a little bit surprised at. It seems that it was a one-day event, and, you know, we've just forgotten about it. But like I said, usually you get clusters and volatility, and you would expect some more downside.
Two triggers that seemed to be in play last week also were computer buying. That is, the algorithms made decisions to sell a lot of those stocks, and maybe not people like you or money managers. And also Warren Buffett unloaded so much of his Apple stock that people thought, my goodness, if the smartest man in money doesn't like the best company on earth, then bad times are coming. What's your sort of recollection of those two things?
Well, with Warren Buffett, I think that's a pretty good interpretation. You know, Warren Buffett now has $270 billion in T-bills. He actually has more T-bills than the Fed. He's running a giant money market fund. And if the smartest man in finance can't find anything he wants to buy, then that's not a very good sign.
Yeah.
You know, as for the computer-driven trading, I mean, I think you really saw that in action last Monday morning because, you know, before the market even opened up, S&P 500 futures were down about 4%, which was, I mean, just a huge amount. And I think a lot of that was, you know, stop losses that had been put in place by algorithms. So, you know, like a lot of things in finance, like selling kind of feeds on itself and it begets more selling.
So then what's the investor to do these days? And I don't mean somebody who's picking individual stocks, buying and selling them, although maybe that, but just the rest of us who aren't so sophisticated. What should we all be thinking about right now, Jared?
Well, I think, you know, I think if you're close to retirement, like let's say you're going to retire at 65 and you're 55 years old or 60, and you have a lot of risk in the stock market. Let's say you have a 401k or a retirement account that is mostly stocks. It's probably a good time to be taking down that risk because, you know, let's say we have a big bear market right before you retire, then that's going to affect your standard of living in retirement. So, you know, the closer you get to retirement, you do want to de-risk. And I got to tell you, you know, when I talk to people, this is the number one mistake that people make is that they have too much risk in their late 50s and early 60s. They're just loaded up on stocks. You have to diversify into bonds.
Well, what's the ratio then? Because if you are 65 years old, you might be in the market for another 30 years, right? I mean, you might need money for another 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, the ratio at that age should be around 50-50 at a minimum. You should have 50% of your money in stocks and 50% of your money in bonds. And bonds sound really unappealing, but you have to remember that interest rates have gone up quite a bit in the last couple of years. You know, in the 2010s, it seemed almost suicidal to have any allocation to bonds because they were yielding zero. You know, now even Treasury bond funds are yielding 4.5%, 5%. And if you're in corporate bonds or high yield, you're getting close to 10%. You know, so it's not like you're giving up a lot of, in the way of returns to get exposure to stocks.
Well, for guaranteed money, I mean, is that guaranteed money if it's a municipal bond?
No bond is guaranteed money. I mean, there's duration risk. Like, you can, you know, there can be loss of principal if interest rates go up. So
I'm just trying to think of what the smartest place to park cash would be then.
Well, if you're just looking to park cash, then, you know, what Warren Buffett is doing is a pretty good example. I mean, he's basically in T-bills, which you can get in a money market fund. Also, one good place and earn some yield is short-term investment-grade corporate bonds. They yield a little bit more than they yield about 6%, but they don't have much in the way of risk. And it's a good way. I mean, 6% is really, really good. You know, so any Fidelity, Vanguard, any big mutual fund company is going to have a short-term investment-grade corporate bond fund.
Jared Dillian is the best-selling financial author of the new book, No Worries, How to Live a Stress-Free Financial Life. The website is jareddillianmoney.com. Jared, it's good to hear you today. Thanks for joining us on the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Great. Thanks for having me.
More business news now. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Deerfield-based Baxter International is offloading its kidney care unit. Carlyle Group Private Equity will buy the unit for nearly $4 billion. It's part of Baxter's ongoing effort to streamline operations and pay down debt. The unit, Vantiv, had revenue of nearly $4.5 billion last year with 23,000 employees. The kidney unit made up about a third of Baxter's 2023 revenue. The deal is expected to close later this year or early next year. Chicago has a new healthcare venture fund. It's called Create Health Ventures, and Cranes reports it just closed its inaugural fund that will invest in early-stage business-to-business digital health companies, developing tools for insurance companies and pharmaceutical firms. The fund has $21 million available to those startups and has already cut checks to five companies. Chicago startups Carolel and Advocatia Solutions are included in the first round of funding. One specializes in caregiver engagement and the other is a Medicaid enrollment tool. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Here's the business of food and Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And it's a big, big day for part of Chicago.
This is amazing for the community in our neighborhood.
The Austin neighborhood, where a few years ago,
somebody decided to count how many liquor stores there were versus grocery stores. And we realized that we were, at that point, we lived in a food desert.
Yeah, they counted 23 liquor stores, 2 grocery stores. But it's less of a food desert now, thanks to a new fresh produce market opening today where one of the liquor stores used to be.
It's a beautiful place.
More about that after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. On the phone is
Rodney Williams, and I am the Director of Entrepreneurship and Economic Development for Buy the Hand Club for Kids.
And the Buy the Hand Club was able to buy the lot on North Laramie where there had been a liquor store.
We completely leveled the liquor store from front to back, and we placed a pop-up tent right on that property.
And for 3 years, when it was warm enough, high school students from the Austin neighborhood ran a popular fresh produce market out of that tent. And this afternoon, a brand new brick-and-mortar store is opening.
423 North Laramie.
He says it gives residents of the Austin community a reliable source of fresh produce.
Affordable fresh produce.
But this is about more than produce. It's about the kids who run the market.
They're the ones, you know, taking care of the building from top to bottom, ordering the produce. You name it, they're doing it.
The teenagers are members of the Buy the Hand Club, which is an after-school reading program that looks for kids who are struggling.
You know, to see kids go from really, really bad grades or whatever the case may be and see turnaround and change. The kids that I have in my program, I've never had to visit in the hospital. I've not gotten any calls in the middle of the night that they were shot. These kids really, really, really love what they are doing, and they're focused on just really having a solid, strong future.
Austin Harvest, 423 North Laramie, has its grand opening to the public at 3 this afternoon, and
every day after that from 12 to 6 p.m. in the community, Tuesday, Wednesdays, and Thursdays.
Great story. Well done, everybody.
We are going to be busy. I'm anticipating it.
On the food calendar, today's National Filet Mignon Day. It's National Prosecco Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the business of food and good on 720 WGN.
The Wintrust Business Lunch. Here's a business you may have heard of if you're in the aviation industry, but maybe not otherwise. And yet it's a $2.5 billion company founded in Chicago, operating in 65 countries with 6,000 team members in the refurbished airline parts category, including maintenance and repair. AAR Corporation. Sean Gillen is the CFO at AAR. Sean, you're on WGN. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So is that a fair description of you all? What did I miss there?
Yeah, quite right. So we've been operating in the Chicago area since 1955, celebrating 70 years next year. And we do aviation services, which is kind of exactly what you said. We do maintenance on airplanes. We repair parts. We repair the aircraft. And then we also distribute parts on behalf of other manufacturers. So we're not a manufacturer ourselves. We're a service provider to the commercial aviation industry.
Where do you get refurbished parts for airplanes?
Good question. We get them from airlines. So when they have parts that break that need a repair, we get them from the airline. We can also get them from the government, who has aircraft and parts that are what's called commercial derivatives. So they're, you know, commercial aircraft parts that are just used in government applications. And then we'll get them from other maintenance providers as well. You know, they'll have parts on their shelf that we can trade or that they need a repair done on, and we will do that for them. So it's a big, large ecosystem of commercial and government aviation, and we're a player right in the middle of it.
I never thought about it. I mean, if I have a part that needs replaced at my car, I go to the garage or to the dealer, or I go to one of those auto parts stores. There's the equivalent of that in the airline industry?
That's exactly right. So, you know, the garage we have is a hangar on airport property. And that's where we will have large aircraft, whether it's a United, a Southwest, and we do what's called heavy maintenance work. So every 4 years or so, those aircraft that we all fly on need a complete maintenance event where everything gets checked and the things that need replacing get replaced. And we do those at our hangars. So it's not the garage on the corner for an automobile, but it's a hangar on an airport for an aircraft.
We were reminded not that long ago on this show that airline travel is eminently safe, safer than it's ever been. And yet we also have reports of doors blowing out and window seals failing. What do you say about the safety of the industry or the parts that you're providing?
Yeah, you know, and safety is our number one, corporate principle in terms of what we focus on, because we acknowledge that we're part of that ecosystem. And the safety and quality of everything we do is critical to people flying all over the world. And as you mentioned, you know, the industry has had a track record of safety over the last 20 years or so, which is really unprecedented. That doesn't mean that there are not incidents like the ones you've referenced that we've all read about. But I think what that shows is that it's important for everyone who touches an aircraft or an aircraft part, whether it's the manufacturer, an airline, or, you know, maintenance workers like ours, that we all need to be focused on safety and quality, because that's the number one, that's the number one important thing.
I was glad to hear you just say now, Sean, that every 4 years those planes get an overhaul?
Correct. They come in and there's a big long checklist that our technicians do in coordination with the airlines. And all that, you know, gets checked, fixed, and sent back to the airline.
Mm. So it would seem to me, though, that like so many other industries, the technology is changing so rapidly. And I'm not even thinking about AI, but just all of the computers and gizmos these days. How do you all keep up with that? And are there refurbished parts for those?
For those, there are. We're not in that market. I would say one of the things that we're very focused on is bringing digital solutions to our hangars. Today, the way that aircraft gets repaired, it's still a very paper-intensive process. You have manuals and task cards and sign-off sheets, and all that's critical to again, the safety and quality. But what we're doing is starting to put that in a digital format that allows the technician, the mechanic, to be more efficient in their work, and it creates an easier way for us to hand all that critical information back to the customer. And so they have greater traceability and insight into all the work that was done. So that's one area that we're really using some digital tools, and we're kind of pioneering that in the heavy maintenance space. For the aftermarket, and we're really proud of the early signs of that and look forward to rolling it out across our hangar network.
Well, do the dashboards on airplanes have a little orange light that comes on, like on my car, and then it tells you exactly what needs to be done?
It's a little bit like that. More we have to kind of tap into that computer to kind of understand, what needs to be done. So it's not quite the same, but similar in concept.
Well, hopefully you're not ignoring it the way I'm ignoring mine.
No, safety first, quality always is what we say, and we'll make sure we check every single one of those lights.
Sean, has business been good for AAR?
Yes. The company grew at 17% last year. We actually had a record year in terms of both sales and profitability. We've completed two acquisitions in the past year, so we're growing not only organically but also via acquisition. And everything you hear and read about the demand for flights and people getting on airplanes, that's all positive for our business. So we've seen a big increase in demand for our services coming out of COVID, and expect that to continue as well.
One last thing. Are you hiring? Who do you need?
We are hiring. Labor is tight everywhere, as we know. And our mechanics, our technicians are in the same group. So we are constantly hiring at our hangars, and that's our main focus.
Yeah. Sean Gillen, CFO AAR, that's AARCorp.com. Fascinating and good to hear. Sean, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's AAR Corporation.